Shortly after God made Adam, he took him on a tour of the rest of creation. "This is all amazing," Adam said. What are you going to do next?" "I've decided to make you a companion," God replied. "I'm going to make her from your body, so you'll be completely compatible in every way. She'll always respect and admire you. She will always say exactly what she means at all times. She'll respond to every situation with logic and rationality. And she will quickly accept accountability when she's wrong. She'll have faith in you. She'll be supportive of you and always give you the benefit of the doubt. She will consistently be on time for events. She'll never hide her insecurities behind a veneer of vanity. And whenever you have a conflict, she'll always let you have the last word." "Well, wow," Adam said. "She sounds great. But you said you're going to have to make her from my body. So what is this going to cost me?" "Well," God replied, "in order to create her, I'll need one of your lungs. I'll need your left foot, a piece of your heart and your liver, a kidney, and 3 vertebrae." "Oof," Adam said. That's an awful lot to give up. What can I get for a rib?" "Yeah, I know it's a corny joke, but hey, it's my podcast and I can be corny if I want to be." So welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Faith by Reason podcast. The website behind it all is faithbyreason.net. Go check it out and check out all the information that I have there. And obviously, we are going to be talking about Adam and Eve. Well, more specifically, we're going to be talking about the first dispensation. The dispensations are God's contrastive way of showing that his plan for humanity is the right one. So why does God need to have a contrastive plan for humanity? Why is he being contrastive? Well, as we talked about in the last couple of podcasts, the only way to be right, to be righteous, is to be contrastive, to consider the possibility that you could be wrong and try to prove yourself wrong. And if you can't prove yourself wrong, then you can be pretty comfortable that you're right. And since God is righteous, God is contrastive. God is humble. Contrastive thinking is, the biblical word for contrastive thinking is humility. And why do we need to be contrastive? Why do we need to be right? Well, because we found out that the meaning of life is to be with God forever, which means we have to be like God, which means we have to be righteous. So that's what contrastive thinking is all about, is being more right and being more righteous. And we know that God's plan for us is to get us to the point where we will be like him so we can spend eternity with him. But since he is just and right, he wants to give man every opportunity to choose the right plan on his own. So that's what these dispensations are. These are periods of time where God gives man the opportunity to either choose righteousness or to choose to go his own way. And of course, man usually chooses to go his own way. God knows this, but he is contrastively trying to give man the opportunity to do it on his own, to choose righteousness on his own. Now, as we said in the last podcast, don't get caught up with the term dispensation. Don't let that throw you off. I'm not a dispensationalist. This isn't a podcast about dispensationalism. I don't agree necessarily with all the doctrines surrounding dispensationalism. The reason I use the word dispensation is because it is a common word that people understand, that Christians know. So if the word dispensation makes you uncomfortable, then just think of them as periods of time. So we are going to talk about the very first dispensation, the so-called dispensation of innocence, when you have only 2 human beings on the earth with no knowledge of good and evil. And the question that is asked is, will they choose righteousness on their own or will they go their own way? And of course, since this is the first dispensation after creation, it kind of starts at the end of the creation on the 6th day. On day number 6, God created man. The Bible says that God made man from the dust of the earth, from the soil of the earth, and he made man in the image of God. We'll talk about what that image means in just a moment. But God made man's physical body out of the dirt, out of the soil. And, you know, that makes sense from a biological standpoint, because if you look at the things that make up our components, our hair, our eyes, our skin, our internal organs, when you break them all down, they're really made out of the stuff that's in soil, you know, carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and the lipids and things like that. You can find all of those in the soil. And when we die, when we cast off this mortal coil, we go back into the ground. Our bodies decompose back into soil. We pretty much become fertilizer. So he made our physical bodies out, or we made Adam's physical body out of the dust of the earth. And he called him Adam, or Adama, which means man. And Genesis 2 says that he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. that's really important. It's not just that he, you know, blew on Adam and he, you know, started, you know, coughing and wheezing and became a living soul. What that breath means in the Greek, it's pneuma, and that's the word that is used for the spirit. So what it's saying here is that he created man, you know, as a physical being, but then he gave him a spirit. And that spirit means that man is eternal. We talked about that in some of the early podcasts. I'm thinking of podcast numbers 2 and 5, where we talked about what spirit is and how spirit is eternal. And that's one of the things that makes man unique, is that man, human beings, have a spirit. And God directly gave him a spirit. And Adam became the first earthly son of God. And what that means, he's a direct creation of God. And that term son of God will be very important when we talk about the flood in Genesis 6, but you know, I'm getting ahead of myself. And the Bible says that God gave man authority over all the rest of creation. He gave him authority over the birds and the fishes and the wild animals, the wild land animals, and over, you know, all the plant life. He gave man control of the earth. He basically made man the king. He made Adam the king of the earth. The earth was his. He gave him his authority. And that's what the term image bearer means. It doesn't mean, when the Bible says that God made Adam in his own image, it doesn't mean that, you know, he looks like God. It doesn't mean that God has two arms and two legs and a head full of hair like a human being. No, it means that he made Adam his image bearer. What does image bearer mean? That means that he has God's authority. He is God's image on the earth. And then that was day 6. And on day 7, it says that God rested. And that's really important. Let's break down what that means when it says God rested. Now, it doesn't mean that God was tired. It wasn't like God said, "Ooh, these last 6 days of creation, man, they've just worn me out. I'm going to sit back on my eternal easy chair and have a bag of Cheetos and a beer because I am so wiped out." No, it didn't cost God that much effort to create the world in the 6 days. He wasn't resting. What it really means, if you look at the actual breakdown of the etymology, what it's saying is that God ceased his activity. He ceased his activity of being the first cause. Now, it doesn't mean God's no longer the first cause. Of course, he's the first cause. He's always and completely right and just. We've been talking about that for most of these podcasts. It means he ceased his activity of being the first cause. He ceased being the initiator of his will. What he becomes is a reactor, not a reactor, not like a nuclear reactor. He becomes a reactor. He no longer initiates. After the seventh day, God becomes someone who reacts to what man does. God gave that authority, that first cause authority, to Adam. Adam is now the first cause. Adam, on earth anyway, is the king. He is God's image bearer. He has God's authority. God gave it to him, and Adam is the one who initiates from now on. And God no longer initiates his will. He reacts to it. Now, I know some of you may say, well, that's sacrilegious. Of course, God initiates his will whenever he feels like it, because he's God. He can do whatever he wants. Of course, God can do whatever he wants, obviously, within his nature. But God chose to give his authority to man. He chose to cease his activity as the first cause. And if you don't believe me, go through the Bible and look at everything that God does. God only acts as a reaction to what men do, or he takes action to equal out justice, but he does not initiate anything. You look at what happened right after, well, you know, obviously we have original sin, which we'll talk about soon, but then you have the flood. What was the flood? The flood was a reaction to what the earth was like, what man had done. Then you look at the Tower of Babel, and when God came down to judge them because of what they were doing, which was not a good thing. And of course, we'll talk about that when we talk about Babel, but God reacted to them. So God, throughout the rest of the Bible, God reacts. He does not initiate his will. And this actually is a good explanation or a continued explanation of what we talked about a few podcasts ago about the nature of man. And when we looked at the question of why does a good God allow evil things to happen? And it's because God does not initiate his will on man unilaterally. God reacts. So that's why man commits evil, and then God then, that's why man can't commit evil without God interfering most of the time, but then God can, you know, equal out justice and judge him for it, but God does not stop him before he does it. That's why God doesn't, nine times out of ten, God doesn't stop man from doing evil, but he reacts after man does evil, because on that seventh day, God ceased his activity from the first of being the first cause, and he gave that authority, for better or worse, to man. So Adam's on earth. He is now, Adam is the king of the earth, and he has everything he could possibly need. God gives him all this authority, and he also gives him provision. He says, you know, you can eat of, if you wouldn't eat food, you can eat of any of the trees of the garden, any of the fruit of any of these trees you can eat. So apparently when man and woman first started out, they were all vegans, which means the first thing that Adam probably said to Eve is, "Hi, Eve, I'm a vegan." Why? Because vegans love to tell you that they're vegans. There is nothing a vegan loves more, other than plants, than telling you that they're a vegan. They're like atheists and people from New York. We talked about this a few podcasts ago. You could always tell when someone is an atheist or if someone's from New York, because within the first 2 minutes of talking to them, they will tell you that they're an atheist or they're from New York. And we could add vegans to this category, because vegans will happily tell you that they're vegans, whether you ask them or not. It's like the second thing out of their mouth. "Hi, my name is Joe. I'm a vegan." Oh, nobody cares, Joe. Who cares? I mean, it's more meat for me. I'm not a vegan. I love meat and I love bacon, and I'm glad there are a lot of vegans, because the more vegans there are, the more bacon for me. Anyway, Adam can eat from all the trees of the garden. That's his provision, except for one. He cannot eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because God said on the day he eats of it, he will die. And obviously this is very important, because this is the contrastive opportunity, or the contrastive issue that God has put in this first dispensation, to give man the opportunity to either choose to be righteous or choose his own way. And this tree is involved in that. So you have these two main trees. You have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. And Adam can eat of all the trees except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which means he could eat of the tree of life, which, as the name implies, will probably continue have him sustain his physical life, which means as long as he ate from the tree of life, he can continue to live in his physical body forever. So everything is good with Adam, right? Well, not so much, actually. Shortly after God creates him, God said, you know what? It's not good that man is alone. Man is by himself. And God knows that it's not good to be alone, because God's not alone. God is a Trinity. He's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God's not alone. And so he knows it's not good for man to be alone. So what does good mean? Well, we're going to get into a detailed definition of good and evil in an upcoming podcast. But for now, suffice to say that good is about being able to create value and being profitable. So basically, it's not valuable or not profitable for man to be alone. Man by himself cannot create any value, and he's not profitable. And so God says we need to make for him a helper or a helpmate, or helpmeet, if you look at the King James Version. Now, that's an unfortunate translation, that helper thing, because it makes it sound like Eve is Adam's like assistant or his secretary. That's not true. That word helper is azor or azor kenegdai, which in Hebrew means literally life giver or life saver, the one who gives life meaning. So basically Adam's life has no meaning without this companion. And Adam needs this companion in order to give his life meaning, in order to be profitable. So again, since God is no longer the first cause, he has to be contrastive. What he did, he brought every animal to Adam for him to name. And this wasn't just so Adam could come up with fun names for animals. It was to show Adam contrastively that no other being in creation, no other animal in creation could meet the need, his azor kenegdai, his helper, his helpmeet, his lifesaver. No other animal could do it. So now that Adam went through all the animals and he saw them all, and none of them could be that companion, now that he did that, God can react and say, okay, now I can initiate another creation, and I can create Eve. So he puts Adam to sleep, he takes a rib, and he creates woman. He creates Eve. And when Adam wakes up and he sees her, he is so thrilled. What does he say? He says, "Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," which doesn't sound terribly romantic, but maybe it was, you know, back 6,000-7,000 years ago, that was a kind of a Hallmark card statement. So now you have Adam and Eve, and they are both the king and queen of the earth. It's very important. Eve is not subservient to Adam. She is not his assistant. She is not his helper. They are both co-rulers, and they are in the garden, and the Garden of Eden is paradise, and that is really important for us to understand, because Eden is this perfect atmosphere, this perfect community, this perfect way of being. So as God put them in this garden, which God watered, God planted, that's where all of the trees they could eat were. They were in Eden, and Eden was this perfect situation of a situation where everything was perfect for man and woman. So you had perfect provision. You had everything they could eat. You had perfect fellowship. They had a perfect loving fellowship. Remember, we said that loving fellowship requires three. And three, in this case, like with any godly marriage, is the husband, the wife, and God, each loving each other directly and receiving love indirectly. So they had perfect fellowship. They had the perfect community. They had the perfect governance. And how was that perfect governance? It was God was the head. He would give instructions and he would teach Adam. Adam would relay those to Eve, not because Eve was less than Adam, but because that was just the hierarchy they agreed upon. God is a God of order. Even in the Trinity, all members of the Trinity are equal, but they have agreed harmoniously to have a hierarchy where God the Father is number one, God the Son is number two, and God the Holy Spirit is number three. Not because one is better than the other, but because they just agreed on this hierarchy that works. And this is the same thing with the marriage. God is number one, the husband is number two, and the wife is number and Adam is the head of the man is the head of the wife, and the husband and wife together, Adam and Eve together, were over all of creation. That was how things were supposed to be. It was a perfect situation. They had that perfection. And what's important about this is that it really gives us an insight into all of our desires. And we're going to talk about this quite a bit down the road. If you want to get a head start, I would go to the blog post called Jonesing for Eden, where I really explain that all of our desires have to do with our need, our desire to get back to Eden. Human beings, we were optimized for Eden. We were optimized. We are only going to be happy when we are in a situation where we have perfect governance, perfect community, perfect fellowship, perfect provision. We've been wanting that since we lost it, which we lost when original sin happened, and we want to get back there. And everything that we do, all of our desires are really to get that perfection, to get back to that state of perfection that we can't get on earth. But because we're fallen, we want to get there without God. Now, of course, when we get to the end of the dispensations and God implements his plan, we will be back in a state of paradise, but we can't get there without God. And all of the things that we try to do in our current fallen state is to get Eden without God. I mean, think about it. Look at the governments that man sets up. What are the purpose of our governments? To make people behave in a more perfect way, to give perfect provision through the governments, to laws to get people to be in perfect community. We create these things without God in order to try to get back to Eden, because that's what we all want. I mean, think about it. No matter what your political, social philosophy is, everyone wants the same things. We all want to love and be loved. We all want to be taken care of. We all want to have provision. We all want to have purpose. And we all want to have a perfect community. We want all those things. And the history of man is a history of us trying to get all of those things without God and failing miserably to do it. And when we can't do it, we try to make it happen. We try to force Eden on other people in the form of, again, different governments and different social political philosophies and different economic philosophies. All of these things are man's attempt to get back to that perfection. And we never have been able to do it, nor will we be. And again, we'll talk about that in the future. But another point I need to emphasize is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God told Adam not to eat of the tree. He didn't tell Eve. God told Adam, and then Adam told Eve. So understand that hierarchy. That's hierarchy of that information. That's going to be very important when we get to original sin. So we're talking about Eden. So what else do we know about Eden? We know that Eden was a garden, but it wasn't just a garden. Now, if you look in the biblical account, it says that God planted the garden eastward in Eden. So that means that some part of the east part of Eden was the garden. Well, what was the rest of Eden? What was the western part? Well, we know in part it wasn't. It was at least partially a mountain, because Eden was a garden and a mountain, as well as probably some other space. We know this when we look at one of the famous verses about the fall of Satan, where in Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel 28, when God is giving the judgment on Lucifer, you know, who fell from heaven, he said, you know, you were in Eden, the garden of God. And it also says you were on God's holy mountain in the same sentence, in the same context. So we know that there was also a mountain in Eden. And why is that important? Well, for this next segment, I am greatly indebted to Dr. Michael Heisler. He is a scholar and an author. He's a scholar of ancient Hebrew and Semitic languages. And he wrote a book, which I highly, highly, highly recommend, called The Unseen Realm, Regaining the Supernatural Worldview. And the reason that it's important is because we don't have the supernatural worldview, not in our current society, not here in the 21st century. And that's mostly because we don't really experience the supernatural very much. I mean, we believe it. If you're a Christian, you believe in the supernatural. You believe in a God you've never physically seen. You believe in the virgin birth. You believe that Jesus walked on water and he rose from the dead, and that, you know, God made it flood and all kinds of other miracles. So we tacitly acknowledge that the supernatural exists, but we don't experience it in our day-to-day lives. I can honestly say that I've never really experienced something overtly supernatural. I've never seen anything levitate, or I've never seen a angelic manifestation. Some people have. I'm not one of them. And I think 99.9% of us can say the same thing, that we don't experience the supernatural. But that also clouds our understanding and our interpretation of the Bible, because whenever we look at the Bible in our current modern times, we look at it almost from a purely naturalistic standpoint, and we, you know, give kind of a short shrift to the supernatural stuff in there. We acknowledge them, but we don't really take it all that seriously if we're really honest with ourselves. So when we read something that seems supernatural, we tend to look for the natural approach first, and then if we can't explain it naturally, or if we don't interpret it naturally, then we'll go for the supernatural approach or supernatural interpretation. But when we do that, we're really missing out on quite a bit. Why? Because we have to remember who the Bible was originally written to. It wasn't written to people in the 21st century. Yes, we can read it and apply the Bible to our lives, but it wasn't written directly to us. It was written to people who lived several thousand years ago who actually did experience the supernatural. In this time, we're currently in dispensation number 6, and you can look up the dispensations on the blog to get more insight on that. But we're currently in a dispensation where a lot of supernatural stuff, especially the evil supernatural stuff, is being held back or being restrained by a restrainer. Paul talks about this restrainer in 2 Thessalonians, and again, you can look it up on the blog if you're looking to the series on the church. So I think a lot of things are being restrained that were not restrained in the first 5 dispensations. And a lot of that evil was pretty rampant. I mean, when we look at the so-called gods of the ancients, of the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Babylonians, they all have these gods of, you know, various elements and whatnot. And when we look back at those people, we think that, you know, they were just primitives. The reason that they made up these gods to help them understand the world around them, because they didn't understand the world as well as we do, and because they weren't very bright. Well, that's not really true, because these people, they were not idiots. They created math and science and astronomy that we use today, and we haven't even altered it. We use the same math, astronomy, and physics and things like that that these people discovered thousands of years ago. And there are things that they've done that we haven't been able to duplicate, like the pyramids. And I mean, they had some help with the pyramids, I think. But the point is that they were not stupid. The reason that they believed in these so-called gods with, you know, little g gods, you know, Zeus and Osiris and Horus and all those folks, was because they had regular supernatural encounters with spiritual entities. And they took it for granted. Even look at the time of Jesus. One of the main things that Jesus did a lot of was casting out demons. And when he cast out demons, people were like, oh my God, I've never seen that before. I didn't know demons could exist or could, you know, possess people. No, they took it for granted that he could cast out demons because they knew demons existed. They had regular encounters with the supernatural. And the Bible was written to people who took the supernatural for granted. So we need to read that supernaturalism back in to the Bible in order to really get the full richness of it. And I think Dr. Heisler's book, The Unseen Realm, helps with that. One of the things he talks about is this mountain in Eden. And the reason that is important is because the ancients believed that the so-called gods, these supernatural entities, they lived around mountains and they lived in gardens. the holy mountain of God, which I mentioned in Ezekiel 28, is the mountain of assembly. Who's assembling there? Beings that we call angels. I don't like to use the term angel too much, not because it's completely inaccurate, but because it really only describes a lower level. Angel means messenger. And there is a class of spiritual beings that are solely messengers, but they're kind of on the lower rung on the ladder. They had much more powerful spiritual entities that had much more authority. And this mountain of assembly is where God's divine counsel sat. And that divine counsel is one of the terms that Dr. Heiser uses when he's talking about these angelic beings. God had a certain group of angels, somewhere around 70 to 100 angelic beings that he gave a great amount of authority to, and they were his counsel. They counseled him on things. I mean, not because God needed their opinions, not because he, you know, was lacking anything intellectually. I mean, God has all the information in the world. But the reason that he had this counsel is because God likes giving his authority to other people. He likes sharing his authority, and I think that's awesome. I mean, he did it with Adam and Eve, and he also did it with this divine counsel. And I'll give you an example from the scripture of what this divine counsel did. If you look at the book of 1 Kings, chapter 22, starting in verse 19, and Micah said, "Therefore, hear the words of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven," this divine counsel, "standing beside him on his right hand and his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said one thing and another said another. Then the spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and saying, I will entice him." And that ends at verse 21. So what you have here is you have God sitting on his throne and you have this angelic assembly, this divine council around him. And God asks him a question. Hey, who's going to entice Ahab? Just Ahab is an evil king. It's not important. But the point is that they had a talk amongst themselves. They had a council among themselves. And one angel said one thing, another angel said another thing. And then one said, okay, I'll do it. So this divine council, they made a decision. Not that God needed them, but God enjoys sharing his authority. And I think that's a great thing. So you had on this mountain, you had the assembly of God. And this is not the assemblies of God's churches. Don't get there. But you have God's divine assembly, his divine council. Why is that important? Well, when we understand that, when we understand that supernatural worldview, we understand that not only did Adam and Eve walk with God and they were in constant communication with God, which is why they had no knowledge of good and evil. They didn't have to think about anything. God was always there with them, constantly giving them information. They were in total communion with him. But they also would have been around this divine angelic host. They were in the garden with God, and they were also in the garden with all of these angels, maybe 70 to 100 of them. And that's not something we think about very often, if we think about it at all. It's maybe the first time you've ever thought about the idea that in Eden, there wasn't just Adam and Eve and God. It was Adam, Eve, God, and all of these angels, these angelic beings that were part of his divine council. And one of those beings, let me rephrase that. Because they were used to dealing with the supernatural, with these angelic beings, it really explains a lot about what happens when they're enticed by the serpent, or the nakash, which is a more accurate translation. And we're going to have to get into the nakash, the serpent, and the temptation and the forbidden fruit in the next podcast, because I'm starting to run a little low on time. So we know that's what Eden was. Eden was a garden and a mountain where God dwelt. That was God's physical dwelling place on earth. It was also where he had this angelic host. So God set up his government in Eden, in that plot of land. And Adam and Eve's, their job was to take the rest of the world and make it like Eden. They were supposed to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, which gets back to what we talked about a few podcasts ago, in podcast number 11, that when we talked about how there was a judgment on creation after the fall of Satan, and God recreated the earth, the so-called gap theory and all that, and the earth was pretty barren except for Eden. God planted the garden in Eden, and Adam and Eve's job was to make the rest of the world through them and their offsprings like Eden. They were his image bearers. They had authority on earth to take Eden and make the whole world like Eden. That was their purpose. That was their purpose in Eden. So we know what Eden was. So the question is, where was Eden? And this is really interesting because the Bible gives some topography of where Eden was in Genesis chapter 2. Eden, or rather the Garden of Eden, was surrounded by four rivers, And one of the rivers' name was Pishon. The other was Gihon. Then the other was the Tigris. And the other was the Euphrates. So they was in the midst of these four rivers. Now, Pishon and Gihon, I have no idea where those are. I'm assuming that the children of Israel who was reading this when Moses wrote dictated to them from God, I guess they knew where they were, but they don't exist currently in the topography. We don't know where they are. Now, the Tigris and Euphrates, that's a little different. We do know where those are. Those are in the area, what's called an area of Mesopotamia, which is currently Iraq. So we know that those two rivers were there. We don't know where the other two were. And I guess we can be fairly certain that that's the same Euphrates River, but you have to keep in mind that there were some cataclysmic things that happened between the time of Adam and Eve and, you know, just a few thousand years later. You had the flood, which obviously had a great impact on the topography of the world and changed quite a few things. But apparently the Euphrates River and the Tigris River survived the flood. And I'm going to guess that they were much bigger before the flood, and the flood didn't destroy them. It just reduced them inside. Maybe the silt built up. And here's the interesting thing about Euphrates. It's the Euphrates River is mentioned quite often in the Bible, especially in prophecy, and it's always given great renown. It's where, you know, certain demons were locked up. It has very strong supernatural renown. And so I was really curious to see a picture of it. And when I finally saw the picture of the Euphrates, this great river, it's called a great river in the Bible several times. And you look at it, it doesn't look all that great. I mean, it's not a very impressive body of water. So I think it has more to do with the spiritual aspects of it and its location than it does anything else. But let's assume that since the Tigris and Euphrates are in Iraq, that the Garden of Eden was somewhere in that vicinity, somewhere possibly in Mesopotamia, and most Bible scholars agree with that. So if the Garden of Eden was in Iraq, and we know that the Garden was in the eastern part of Eden, well, then where was the rest of Eden? Where was the mountain of God if the mountain was in the western part? Well, if you go to a map and put your finger on Iraq or Mesopotamia and go west, where do you end up? You end up in the land of Israel. Well, specifically the lands of Jordan and Israel, but the land that we currently call Jordan was part of the land grant of Israel that God gave to the children of Israel. So could it be that Eden was, or most of Eden, the western, northern, and southern parts were the area we called Israel? It would make a lot of sense as to why that plot of land is so important spiritually to God and to God's enemies, because that may have been where the original Eden was, where God's spiritual government was set up on the earth. And maybe that's why all these false religions, all these satanic religions, which every basically religion or faith system that is not Judeo-Christianity is of the devil, is of Satan. And he has been wanting to take Israel. He's wanted God's land for a long time. And I think that's because his ambition has always been, and you can look up the fall of Satan on the blog, his ambition has always been to rule where God rules. So of course he wants Israel. So if Israel was where the mountain of God originally was, then it makes sense that Satan and all the forces of evil want Israel and wants God and God's people out of Israel. But more specifically, what if that mountain of God was Jerusalem? Think about this. Jerusalem is a very important city. It's important spiritually, but it's not that important strategically. I mean, if you look at there are other cities around the world that have more strategic importance, that are on, you know, strategic land, and they have big ports and things like that. Jerusalem's not a port city. It has no great economic advantage. It's actually pretty far inland, and it's on top of a hill, so it's in a mountainous region. So from a strategic and economic standpoint, Jerusalem isn't very valuable, but it's the city that the world is constantly fighting over. And could it be because that is where the original mountain of God's assembly was? And the one of the highest points in Jerusalem is Golgotha, or Mount Moriah, the place where Christ was crucified. Now, I'm not saying this is exactly what happened or this is the exact topography, but wouldn't it be interesting to find out that where Jesus was crucified was the same mountain of assembly where God had his government, his spiritual government when he was on earth? That blows my mind with that possibility. But again, it explains why Israel is so important to the forces of evil. Because if you look at it, Israel's not, it's not strategically important. There's no oil there, unlike some other areas in the Middle East. You know, it has a pretty good, a pretty fertile land where they export a lot of fruits. But from an earthly standpoint, Israel has no real value. It only has spiritual value. And if I'm right about the location of Eden, and I'm not saying I am, it would explain a lot of about why it is so spiritually valuable and why it is such a holy place and why God claims that area as his own. Why God, of all the places in the world, God chose to make that plot of land his nation. Maybe it's because that was the original spot of Eden, and maybe that was the original area where God set up his holy mountain. So interesting stuff to think about. Okay, so we're past the half hour mark. I've kind of gone over, so I apologize for that. But I just think this is so fascinating. I wanted to go through all of the first dispensation and the original sin in this podcast, but I'm obviously not going to get to that. I'm going to have to let that go to the next podcast. So in the next podcast, we are going to talk about the actual fall of man and woman. We're going to talk about the serpent, the Nakash, and we will see that the Nakash, the serpent, was not a snake. It's clearly not a snake. It's actually a being who we know as Lucifer or Satan, because the word Nakash in the actual etymology means the shining one, and it later became to mean snake. But we'll get into that later. So we'll look at man's choice in that first dispensation and eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what it meant. And we'll look at maybe see some pretty surprising things that you may not have known about or maybe not fully acknowledged in original sin. And I will tell you this, that original sin is not what you think it is, or at least not wholly what you think it is, because judgment didn't come when they ate the fruit. Judgment came after. And so it's not so much that eating the forbidden fruit, but it was more about their reaction after they ate the forbidden fruit. So I'll leave you with that hint. And again, I'm over time. I apologize for that. But thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the blog, follow me on social media. And I will see you. We'll talk again next week when we get into original sin. All right. Talk to you next week.